Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect program on chronic myelogenous leukemia, CML, Current Perspectives and Treatment Update. And we're delighted to have all of you on the call today. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration they've been able to reach so many of you. We have on the call today over 857 participants. And you come from all over the United States. You come from large cities and small cities and from suburban areas as well. And we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, the Dominican Republic, and Pakistan. So you really come from just everywhere, and that's really a credit to all of you that you have really chosen to spend the next hour with us. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials we received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there is an outline that has been prepared by our speakers, and there also is information about all of the different partnering organizations as a resource for you with their 800 numbers and websites as really free resources for you. And today's program is made possible by a charitable contribution from Bristol-Myers Squibb, and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. And we have wonderful faculty on the program today. I just want to remind all of you that in your materials as well, there is an evaluation form. And I want to ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the programs you would like us to offer and the topics? You really know best what you want and need. So please do fill out those evaluation forms and make your recommendations. Indeed, today's program and this particular topic is one that we offer throughout the year. It's really based on your really request for this program. So tell us what you want, and we'll really try very hard to deliver what you need. Now, our first speaker today is Dr. Michael Morrow. Dr. Morrow is Associate Professor, Center for Hematologic Malignancies, Knight Cancer Institute, Oregon Health and Science University. And Dr. Morrow is actually going to cover an overview of CML. He's going to talk about the current standard of care and new treatment approaches. He's going to talk about clinical trials. He's also going to talk about the important topic of adherence, or taking your pills on schedule, managing side effects, and communicating with your healthcare team about quality of life concerns. And I want to thank Dr. Morrow for being on the call today and actually for stepping in indeed and covering some of the material that Dr. Jabbour, due to a schedule conflict, is not able to be with us today. So we're delighted to have Dr. Morrow really present the entire medical update for all of you. And I'm now going to turn the program over to Dr. Morrow.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. And good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to everyone. I guess that we have people in every single time zone or many different time zones here listening, so I appreciate your participation in the call. And our task for the next half an hour or so is to talk about the diagnosis of CML and how do we approach it in a standard fashion, what have we learned from recent advances in CML, and what more exciting information might be coming in the months and years to come. And then we'll turn our attention a little bit more to practical management of CML and what it means from the patient side, particularly about taking medication and adherence and compliance, as we call it, and really making sure that the healthcare team is a team and is communicating. So let's just start by talking about the diagnosis of CML and how it's made. Most people with CML are diagnosed, as I say, by serendipity. They're in the office or they're into medical attention for other reasons. And the features of the CML become obvious, that there's an abnormal blood count and a workup ensues. The standard things that physicians will do to work up CML would be, of course, a good history. A physician needs to take a history to understand someone's medical background, and also to perform a good physical exam, and particularly with attention to note if the spleen is enlarged or not. This is part of the staging of CML. From there on in, it's basically things that the hematologist or the oncologist are doing to inquire about the anomaly seen. The blood count is carefully examined, and really most often it's recommended to have a bone marrow study done when there's a question or a high suspicion of a diagnosis of CML in order to really fully stage the condition. the reason for bone marrow at diagnosis is to look for chronic phase, or the earliest and the most common stance that people are diagnosed in, and also to make sure, or it's present so we know about it, to recognize more advanced forms of Philadelphia chromosome positive leukemia, particularly accelerated phase or blast phase. These are treatable as well, just to treat it differently. We need to know that at the beginning. Some of the most important tests that hematologists, oncologists, we do are recognizing the molecular or the underlying defect in CML, which is done via a test called cytogenetics. And this has a lot of technical language regarding how we study the Philadelphia chromosome. But the main test that's done is marrow cells are taken and cultured, and we examine the chromosomes in all 46 pairs of chromosomes in the cell, but with a focus on the Philadelphia chromosome, which is the hallmark of CML, which is a translocation between chromosomes 9 and 22. And there's actually just a shortened chromosome 22 with important juxtaposition or placement of material and blueprints, if you will, which is what DNA really is, on chromosomes, from one chromosome onto another, which leads to production of something called BCR-ABL, which is the abnormal element in CML, and this is the root of the diagnosis. The presence of the Philadelphia chromosome and the genesis of a BCR-ABL protein is what drives CML. BCR-ABL is a what's called a constitutively activated or always activated kinase enzyme, and an enzyme is like a switch, and it leads to the disease of CML. CML is mainly characterized by overproduction of white blood cells, to a lesser degree, actually, overproduction, and moreover, a lack of knowledge of the cells as to when they should die or senesce, and also the cells aren't as likely to stay in the marrow. They circulate in the blood when they should stay in the marrow for longer periods of time. So this is sort of the initial snapshot of how someone should be worked up and what we're looking for with regards to the Philadelphia chromosome and how we do it. The initial clarification of the diagnosis is most important, and again, we really want to ensure that CML is in a chronic phase. There are some things that we can literally put into a mathematical formula: someone's age, how many of the most youngest cells, blast cells, in the blood are found, the platelet count, how big is the spleen, and establish what's called a risk score or a so-called score. And this was something established over 50 years ago, but it's still a good tool to help us understand how is the CML behaving, and what are our expectations for treatment, and how can we optimize treatment. There's actually a website where we can actually calculate the so-called score, and we do it and should do it quite routinely. This helps us estimate what our likelihood of response is with treatment. Now, the treatment of CML has clearly been revolutionized. In 2001, Gleevec, or imatinib mesylate, was approved for use in chronic phase CML and all other phases of CML as well, particularly at that point after previous treatment with interferon, and shortly thereafter we had approval for patients at diagnosis. And the results of the initial trials comparing Gleevec or imatinib to the previous treatment called interferon are some of the most important research data we have. There's a large trial called the IRIS trial, which again took a large number of patients, over 1,000, and randomized them, or with a coin toss. Patients either got interferon-based treatment or Gleevec or imatinib-based treatment. And we now have more than 8 years, and really actually beyond 9 years of follow-up of this trial, and we've learned some very important things. We, of course, have learned that Gleevec is a highly effective therapy for patients with CML. It was vastly superior to interferon. It really completely replaced interferon across the globe as primary therapy for CML, and we seek initial treatment with Gleevec currently still for all patients with CML. We also learned that responses are quite durable. Again, the overwhelming majority of patients will have a blood remission, which is where the blood counts no longer show signs of CML. The white blood cell count is no longer elevated. The platelet count is no longer elevated than it was previously. Immature cells that normally are present in the blood at diagnosis disappear, and the spleen shrinks back to normal. Now, I phrase that way because someone can be in a blood remission and not have completely normal blood counts. It's important to recognize that. The next level of remission, a cytogenetic remission, is when the marrow studies show decreasing proportions of cells with the Philadelphia chromosome. We call them major and complete responses as the main landmarks. The bone marrow is in a major remission when 3/4 of the cells two-thirds of the cells are normal or more, and a complete remission is what you'd expect when none of the cells show the Philadelphia chromosome anomaly. We really focus a lot of our attention thereafter on gauging the remaining level of disease by molecular testing, by PCR testing. And this is a blood-based assay generally, which allows us to measure remaining CML burden when a blood and cytogenetic remission have already occurred. We can also look prior to that, but we really are best using PCR afterwards. And we can see CML shrink down to about when it's 1/100,000 of its original size, when the disease has gone down by 5 to 6 logs from its original starting point. And there's a response criteria which is a bit elusive or foggy still to patients and sometimes physicians, which is called a major molecular response. This is where the CML has gone into remission deep enough where we'd quantify it as being 1/1,000th of its original size, a 3-log reduction. And it means that the leukemia has fallen to 1/10 the size it was when a cytogenetic remission occurred. So it's a deeper remission, and that's really an important landmark that adds to a good outcome, and really achieving that protects patients against the likelihood of their disease recurring or heaven forbid, progressing. One last lesson we learned from the IRIS trial, which has been recently updated in meetings in December, called the ASH meeting, were the likelihood of patients staying in remission over time. And the take-home message from the update of the data was that our wishes have still continued to come true, that when patients are treated with Gleevec-based therapy and have cytogenetic remission and are followed over time, with staying in cytogenetic remission, they actually have a decreasing risk of losing their response or breaking through treatment rather than an increasing risk. There is a few percent per year of patients who do, unfortunately, lose response, and I'll speak in a minute about how they can be treated. But over time, after, say, 3 or 4 years, the likelihood of losing response really decreases, and that's very encouraging. That speaks to the likelihood of patients, once they achieve a stable remission, have an increasing likelihood of staying in a stable remission. And that wasn't something we really could have predicted in the beginning, but is quite good to know. The overwhelming majority of patients are able to take Gleevec and respond to Gleevec, but there, of course, aren't patients who are able to, number one, tolerate Gleevec, and there's a small portion of patients in that group. There's also a proportion of patients who don't, unfortunately, have initial response to Gleevec. Even though the overwhelming majority of those do, there's still a portion that don't. And then there's over a few years, there is a small group that develops of patients who have lost the response to Gleevec. In the years 2004 or so to 2007 and 8, we saw rapid development of second-generation kinase inhibitors, and the names of these drugs are Tasigna, or nilotinib, and Sprycel, or dasatinib. And we have really lightning striking twice in this situation, in a good sense, because we had very good efficacy with Gleevec, or imatinib, and we very quickly saw development through collaboration by academics and from the pharmaceutical industry to develop very potent and actually specifically more potent inhibitors of this BCR-ABL target in leukemia in the same vein, oral once or twice a day medications with very good side effect profiles. And again, the last December in 2009, we saw updates of studies which led to FDA approval for these two drugs for the setting of Gleevec resistant or Gleevec intolerant, or really resistance or intolerance to any prior treatment, but most often to Gleevec, for Tasigna or nilotinib and dasatinib or Sprycel. And the results of those studies over time have showed that the majority of patients, again, are able to, the overwhelming majority are able to either get back into or get into blood remission, and a clear majority are able to get major cytogenetic response, and about half or nearly half of patients are able to get a complete cytogenetic remission. And these are patients who are Gleevec resistant or Gleevec intolerant, and the most of them studied were Gleevec resistant. So we have excellent treatment options for the setting of Gleevec resistance or intolerance. What's probably most current is what you'd be thinking and what you might know about already, and that's that when you have a very good first treatment and then you see you have a very exciting second treatment, you immediately ask the question, why not use the second treatment in the beginning? Why not think of pushing the envelope, and can we do even better than what we've done with Gleevec right at diagnosis? And some of the most exciting recent data is emerging. Again, in December, we saw some of the first data using what are called second-line inhibitors. In this case, the first report was regarding the use of Tasigna or nilotinib for patients newly diagnosed with CML compared to Gleevec or imatinib. And the results were very encouraging. We saw at an early point that the responses were faster and somewhat better with Gleevec. As well, we saw that patients may be protected against progression, that they have better likelihood of staying in remission and not losing their response. And this is probably one of the most important aspects, although all of these are what we call primary or secondary endpoints of the trial. And again, it's still early days, but I think 2010 may be a very important year in CML where we see what we call a paradigm shift, where we see enough proof that these may be a better or more rational and proven option for patients to try at diagnosis. So we might see a shift in using Gleevec at diagnosis or to using the second-generation inhibitors. And I say that as a group because I'd like you to stay tuned, not to me today, but over the next few weeks and months, because we'll actually see further data, exciting data from trials using all of the second-generation inhibitors, update of the early data with Tasigna, and we'll see our first look at the use of Sprycel or dasatinib in patients with newly diagnosed CML in just a few weeks at a meeting called ASCO, the American Society for Clinical Oncology. So that may be even in the news, and it may be the information is available in a limited sense publicly now. So, again, stay tuned for the full results, and, again, stay tuned through 2010 for what I might predict are some paradigm shifts and potential movement of second line or second generation kinase inhibitors into the front line. Now, an important disclaimer here, and this is a bit of my own personal advice as a CML physician, and that's that if someone is in remission on Gleevec, doing well, not having any side effects that are of great concern, I think the best advice is just to celebrate that and not to take concern that one should be moving on to other treatments. The main benefits from these newer algorithms, meaning using a second generation or a newer kinase inhibitor at diagnosis, are for exactly what the trials are showing, that they can put patients into remission faster. If you've already shown that you're in a very stable remission, there might not be a reason to move on to a second generation inhibitor. If you're having side effects from Gleevec, that should always be a question that's discussed with between the patient and their doctor. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. And that may be a reason to switch, but it's obviously a careful decision because, again, results with Gleevec are quite encouraging. So the research and the update doesn't stop there. Of course, there are even further chinks in the armor in that when patients may not respond to Gleevec or imatinib, they also may not respond to Sprycel or to Tasigna. And particularly, the research has gone in a few different directions in this area. But there is very promising work in developing what I would call third generation or third line inhibitors. Let's call them third generation because they may as well work their way forward over time. And there are specific Gleevec-like or targeted agents, such as a drug from a company called Ariad, AP24534, which has shown great promise in what's called a phase one trial, which is still early and really was designed to examine the safety and the tolerability of the drug, but we're definitely seeing the ability to treat patients who haven't had luck with Gleevec nor with Tasigna or Sprycel. And the phase two trials are beginning, and I encourage knowledge of that and to be looking out for those trials, not just that, but others as well, which are being developed in order to treat these very hopefully limited but specific situations where we're yet a third line treatment or a fourth drug really if all three hadn't been an option maybe needed or useful. There's another drug which isn't in the same vein as Gleevec, Tasigna, or Sprycel, which is also a very good agent in CML called homoharringtonin or HHT. A newer name is called omasitaxine epicesinate, and this is a drug which is approaches CML from a slightly different stance by inhibiting protein synthesis, but it's a very well-understood drug. It's been used for many years and has been studied now in this very narrow, fortunately, but specific case where patients may develop specific mutations in BCR-ABL, which is one of the main reasons we believe clinical resistance can develop, or at least one of the main signatures or the signs that we see during clinical resistance when the CML is not in remission anymore or isn't getting into remission. And its studies also show great promise that it may be an effective therapy for such patients. And so stay tuned for that as well. And again, those are just examples of some of the research that's ongoing. Let's turn back to something a bit more positive, the good situation when Gleevec is working. And many people ask, will patients be able to stop the treatment with Gleevec or Sprycel or Tasigna for that matter? The responses are very good. The remissions are very stable. My advice on this front, again, this is a bit my personal advice as a CML physician, is that this is not ready for prime time yet. I definitely would not encourage anyone to be doing that, nor would I encourage physicians to be approaching that. But on the other hand, there is research in this area, and we're trying to understand what the outcome might be should patients in very stable and very deep remissions, what the outcome might be should they stop treatment. And it's clear that there may be fractions of patients that may retain remission without treatment and those that won't, and that when the disease comes back, it comes back rather quickly, which in a sense may be good because it allows us to identify the disease and retreat. But we have a lot of gaps to fill in with regards to predicting who not has a risk of relapse, and certainly questions regarding the stability and the quality of remission that someone might regain. So I would say, I know that's a question on many people's minds, that's why I mention it, but I just wanted to advise caution and leave that to the realm of clinical trials. So let's talk about the nuts and bolts now for a few minutes and how to manage side effects and the importance of taking your treatment on schedule. Now, CML really has become a disease or a condition that used to be described as one that would last for a few years, but it now may last for many, many years and be very controlled and treated and maybe, in essence, a chronic control condition. And the treatment paradigm or the treatment algorithm is different than most cancer treatments. Most people think of cancer treatment as something that would come and go. I sort of have to put up with it for a period of time, and then it'll stop, and I'll be in remission, or I won't, and that's the general set of rules. And we've really broken the rules in CML. CML is a disease that's treated with a generally well-tolerated choices, oral medications that we could take at home. Once or twice a day, generally. There are obviously other treatments people need to move on to, even up into bone marrow stem cell transplant, which are much more involved. But the bulk of patients really do have exposure and use of the oral drugs, the kinase inhibitors, and it's very important to continue to take them. I just caution you that we really don't understand the implications of patients stopping treatment, and that should not be done. That's not advisable. We know that to maintain remission, patients need to continue to take therapy. We can't be relaxed or slack off with regards to the dosing or the interval. And, you know, if the treatment is well tolerated, it's simply just a matter of being mindful of it and continuing to stay on top of the daily administration. One of the easiest ways to see that deteriorate is if there are side effects. And we know there are common side effects for all of the medications I've mentioned. Some common side effects of Gleevec include muscle cramps, swelling or fluid retention, particularly around the eyes or in the ankles. Gastrointestinal side effects. It can be hard on your stomach. It can make your lower GI tract move a bit faster and need to go to the bathroom more often. It can cause rash and laboratory abnormalities, some things that are a bit more involved that may be picked up by your doctor or picked up by a hematologist, oncologist. So they're obviously common side effects. The newer drugs, Tasigna and Sprycel, have their own side effects that are somewhat different than Gleevec as well. Some of these include headache, some other laboratory changes which we need to monitor for, including pancreas enzymes and focus on the liver enzymes and electrolytes or salts in the blood like phosphorus and whatnot, and as well as some other clinical syndromes, pleural effusions, which is a collection of fluid between the chest and the chest wall and the lung, which simply needs to be recognized and managed directly, and it's something side effects in general can be quite easily managed if A, the patient is quite keen to tell their doctor if something's happening, B, the doctor is seeing the patient regularly and asking the right questions, and there's an open line of communication, so we can identify things early, manage them properly, and move on. And moving on sometimes is complicated. It may mean a stop in treatment. It may mean a change in the dose. It may mean a switch in treatment. And the communication lines need to stay wide open under those circumstances. We all understand what's happened, what options remain, and how we're going to proceed to continue to treat CML well, because it's really a wonderful era. We should only be so lucky in treating cancer to have this set of options for many other diseases where we have very good primary therapy with Gleevec or imatinib. We have excellent ability to treat in the setting of Gleevec resistance or intolerance with Tasigna or nilotinib, as the other name, or Sprycel, which also goes by the name dasatinib. And we have multiple newer drugs which continue to move through development, AT24534, homoharingtonin, many other drugs which are filling the chinks in the armor, as they might call it, for the rare cases when the other drugs haven't worked. Stem cell transplant remains an option, and if I see a patient and that is something that patient may consider, it's definitely something needs to be discussed. It shouldn't be sort of left in the dark. Some initial testing can be done to sort out whether someone has a donor or not, and that's really the most and first and foremost question. So we shouldn't forget about that, and it remains a proven curative option for CML and an option that many patients pursue. To a variable degree in various parts of the world. In some places, stem cell transplant is much more of an exercise option, and that's often quite reasonable because if a patient is of appropriate age and has a good donor, again, can be a safe procedure, although there are some risks and more risks perhaps than taking oral targeted therapy, but it can, be a curative option. The medications Gleevec, Sprycel, and Tasigna, I think at this point represent a tremendous advance and an ability to exquisitely control CML for what appears to be an extended period of time. Exciting news continues to be developed, so I encourage you to stay tuned for more updates on how we're going to best use these medications. I encourage everyone to particularly pay attention to the second half of this year when we see more and more information about how we might reconsider what we do at diagnosis, because the entire field is looking at this information very carefully, from the FDA downward, and we might see some paradigm shifts. I encourage you to stay tuned to clinical trials. I encourage you to participate in clinical trials. If you hear about one or know about one, if your doctor recommends one, consider it carefully. Get all the information you need. Physicians out there need to properly inform patients about the risks and benefits, but the advances I've just spoke about couldn't have taken place without the hard work of researchers getting patients who are potentially candidates for studies onto treatment and following them carefully, and for patients that are gracious enough and brave enough to be willing to participate in clinical trials. And that's how we move the field forward. I encourage people to continue to keep those lines of communication wide open with physicians. You know, it's 2010. There's many different ways to communicate, some newer and even more fun ways rather than leaving messages on phones, and make sure you have a good dialogue with your physician so you know what's happening and so they're explaining everything, and there's no stones unturned. And lastly, I think what we want to leave a bit of time for a second colleague here who's I'm going to let Carolyn introduce, who could talk to you about some other resources that might be available through organizations like Cancer Care. So I thank you for your attention, and I'll be answering some questions for you later.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mora, for really doing a terrific presentation and really covering the entire scope of CML, its treatment, its management, side effects, and the importance of doctor-patient communication and the importance of taking pills on schedule. So thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Richard Dickens. And Rick is an oncology social worker. He's program coordinator of blood cancers, project coordinator mind-body program at Cancer Care. And Rick is going to tell you about some of the support services that you can access from Cancer Care. Rick?
Thank you, Carolyn. And thank you, Dr. Morrow. I appreciate the educational and expert advice you provided. in the, I think it was a very, very meaningful presentation. I, as an oncology social worker who specializes in blood cancers, found it very informative. Most people don't realize their oncology care will be handled by a healthcare team, which includes their doctor, an oncology nurse and social worker, and often a physical therapist, chaplain, and other specialists. While each member of the of your team specializes in a certain area, they are all working together to coordinate your care. When a doctor is not available to answer a concern, you can turn to the nurse or social worker who are aware of your treatment plan and can often offer expert advice or guide you to someone who can. For CML patients and families, there are numerous issues related to treatment which can impact your lives, including concerns about treatment, insurance, jobs, or who will help loved ones. Additionally, issues of self-esteem due to side effects, as well as treatment-related fatigue, which can impact normal daily activities of daily living. At some point, the whole process will become familiar to you, and you will develop what is often called a new normal. That is why building relationships with your healthcare team are so important. For many, it is helpful to think of this relationship as a partnership or collaboration. Your oncology team are experts in your cancer and treatment, but you are the expert of your body and your life. For that reason, mutual respect can go a long way to foster the best supportive care. Here are some tips that could guide you along this process. Do your research. The internet is a good place to start, but there are helpful organizations such as Cancer Care that can guide you through this process as well. Becoming a knowledgeable consumer will go a long way toward giving you a sense of control. Number two, take your time. With a diagnosis of CML, you usually have some time before you must make medical decisions. Saying, "I need a day to think about this," can give you an opportunity to catch your breath and get feedback from loved ones. And finally, speak up. Don't be afraid to bring up any topic of concern to your healthcare team. Remember, your doctor and oncology team can't treat a problem if you don't make them aware of it. Accepting changes are normal during treatment and can go a long way toward nurturing your body and spirit. These changes can affect sexual and body functions and elicit feelings of sadness, anger, fear, and frustration. At the same time, what is happening to the patient can make family and friends feel helpless, scared, and sad as well. During these times, it is often helpful to seek the help of a social worker or other healthcare professional from organizations such as Cancer Care. At Cancer Care, we inform people of resources and strategies for finding help. We assist many patients with financial grants and offer counseling by oncology social workers, as well as run regional face-to-face groups and national telephone and online support groups for patients and loved ones. These groups provide role models, emotional support, coping strategies, and validation that you're not alone in what you feel. To many, support groups and social supports go a long way in helping to confront the difficult challenge of cancer. And daunting as they are, with help, they are never impossible. Cancer Care can be reached by phone at 1-800-813-HOPE or online at www.cancercare.org. And I wish you all the best. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you very much, Rick, and thank you for that wonderful welcoming introduction to Cancer Care and letting people know about all the different services that we offer. People take advantage of those services, so thank you so much. And we now have time for questions. We actually have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to bring all of our speakers on board, and if you could explain to the audience how to queue up for questions. And if we don't get to your question, because this is a very large call, please know that you can call Cancer Care at the end of the call at 1-800-813-HOPE, and our staff will be here to answer your questions. So we'll take as many of your questions as possible, but again, if we don't get to your question or you have a question after the call, just give us a call and we'll be sure to answer it. Mary?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Jacqueline W.
Hello, this question is for Dr. Morrow. I hope you can hear me.
Yes,
absolutely.
Thank you, Carolyn. If the Philadelphia chromosome translocation is present at birth, what turns on the phenomenon in later life? Because you're obviously, you know, many times you don't get CML until later life. Thank you very much.
Well, that's a very good question. I think we sometimes skip explaining about how we believe the Philadelphia chromosome develops and how it's part of CML. And in fact, Philadelphia chromosome occurs through what's considered to be a common error during blood development and blood division. Our blood is always turning over. Our blood is one of the most regenerative organs in our body, much like our skin and our hair and nails. And chromosomes 9 and 22, which are the pieces that make up the Philadelphia chromosome, are unfortunately very close to each other during cell division. When cells divide, 1 makes 2, makes 4, makes 8, makes 16, etc. And that's the way we believe this happens, that there's a translocation or a swapping event which happens, and this is not at birth, so this is not in at the time someone's beginning to develop. This is prior to the development of the CML. So really, within the months or perhaps an undefined period of time prior to, but it's not felt to be what's considered a constitutional or an anomaly seen at birth. So again, we sometimes forget to mention that. And it probably answers many questions for people. They ask about what might be the risk to offspring, to children. CML is not an inherited disease that we can tell. And there's some very interesting literature out there that the error of the Philadelphia chromosome may occur in a higher number of people than those that actually then are diagnosed with CML ultimately. So there might be some research that comes along over the years that helps us understand why it essentially takes hold and why it causes a disease. But that's the answer to that question.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Mary M.
Oh, yes. Hi there. My question would be looking at a possible Gleevec non-response or Gleevec failure. Is the BCR able marker, can that just be a single marker to determine when all the other hematological levels are normal? Can the BCR-ABL be the single marker to make a determination that Gleevec has failed or there's no response?
A very good question, and that gets to something that I wish, had I had a little bit more time, I would have explained, so let me explain it now. So we have certain expectations as we treat people with whatever treatment we're using. Let's use Gleevec as an example. When someone is diagnosed, they have an abnormal CBC or an abnormal blood count. And when that corrects, it's called a complete hematologic response. And that we expect to happen within the first few weeks or really no later than 3 months. We then expect patients over the next ensuing months to have a cytogenetic or bone marrow-based cytogenetic response. And we have time frames with which to work in. We expect patients to have some response by 6 months. Some more aggressive guidelines would say some response by 3 months. We expect perhaps a major reduction by 6 months by, again, stricter guidelines, and a complete remission somewhere between 12 and 18 months, depending on what you look at. So when the blood counts may be normal, the BCR-ABL gene, or the BCR-ABL as manifest in cells in the bone marrow that have the BCR-ABL translocation, the Philadelphia chromosome, TCR that shows evidence of the BCR-ABL at certain levels, yes, can be proof that Gleevec's not working well enough or Gleevec has stopped working. And we gauge that by, has someone had enough response by a certain period of time based on our best research that's shown us that if you hadn't had that response at that time, your likelihood of getting into that response with more time seems quite low. And it may exceed the chances that backward movement would be seen. Now, of course, if someone was in response and had an increase in BCR-ABL levels, which can be measured by, again, direct measurement of BCR-ABL blueprints or DNA, RNA by PCR or by chromosome testing. So backward movement is fairly straightforward, but not getting into a deep enough response by a certain period of time is also considered sometimes not enough, sometimes what we call suboptimal response, and also can be considered failure. Not that the patient failed, the treatment failed the patient. So that's how that works. The blood counts can be normal, but we expect people to move into deeper and deeper remissions over time or to obviously stay in their category of remission and to never lose their category, never to move backwards. So either of those would qualify as a situation with Gleevec's not working.
Thank you very much. Our next question.
Our next question comes from Linda L.
Yes, Dr. Morrow. Hi. I was wondering if we could talk a little more about the trial drug, the 24534. Any information you could give me on that would be helpful.
Certainly.
Thank you for the question. Yeah.
Yes, certainly. Just as a bit of an overarching comment, if anyone ever wanted to know about an experimental therapy or an experimental therapy at an institution, I think as my colleague Rick mentioned, you know, the internet is a very good place to start. There, the NCI, National Cancer Institute, requires that clinical trials are listed, clinicaltrials.gov, on the internet. So you can find them. You can see if which doctor is involved in the trial. Is the trial open? Is the trial not open? A bit about the trial. And of course, if you know of a specific hospital, generally, for example, my own institution, OHSU, our Knight Cancer Institute has a website where patients can hopefully easily search through clinical trials. But the trial I mentioned is in its earlier stages. The drug is nearing completion of what we call a phase one trial, where we look and phase one, phase two, and phase three. And just to explain, the phase one is where the medicine is first taken. Into patients, and we look for the safety and the tolerability, and we establish what dose is safe to proceed with, and hopefully a bit about how well it's working, and that's where we are. There was an initial report in December about the safety and tolerability of that agent, the AP24534, which is an oral medicine, and so far it appears safe. It appears to have activity in patients with CML who have not responded to Gleevec or other medications in sequence. It has shown activity against patients who have what's called a T315I mutation, which is a specific mutation that unfortunately isn't sensitive to any of the three other drugs. And at this point, the phase one trial is coming to a close, and we're transitioning, and it will be transitioned into a phase two trial. Now, a phase two trial will take the dose that's been examined and is declared to be a safe dose, and study it further in particular patient populations. And I think it's safe to say that it will continue to be explored aggressively in CML, but there may be other diseases as well. This is a drug, like many others, that may have other applications. So stay tuned for the potential other diseases even, which could be treated by it. So very exciting times, but still, unfortunately, in development, I would say. So we have to be a little bit patient with regard to the fact that the careful questions that are part of a phase one trial need to be answered about the dose and the safety. The drug has to be manufactured and formulated so it can be delivered to larger numbers of patients for larger trials. Trials themselves have to be written and planned so we can safely proceed. But I think that it's moving as quickly as possible. So there hopefully won't be any real lag time here, but if there is, it would be expected time that's needed to do those things I talked about, which is really to very carefully examine what we've learned from the first trial and then very carefully but quickly prepare for the next trial so we can continue to give access to patients these exciting options like the AP24534 compound.
Excellent. And, you know, for cancer clinical trials, the National Cancer Institute is, as Dr. Morrow and Rick have said, is a wonderful resource. And you can go to their website at www.cancer.gov, or you can call them on the phone if you don't have internet access at 1-800-4-CANCER. And it's just a great resource for you to really learn more about trials that might be available. So that's just an excellent resource. Our next question.
Carolyn, could I just jump in there, too, also and say the NCI is really helpful because their representatives are medically trained if you do call them. The website's really very comprehensive and very big, but if you do call them directly, they'll do searches for you, and they're very well trained as well.
It's true, and they really will do it. It's a very good point. I mean, some of you like to do your own searches, but it's nice to have someone who is trained to do that do it for you, and then you can also do it yourself. So, you know, definitely take advantage of these free services that are available for you. Thanks. Our next question?
Our next question comes from Karen C.
Yes, hi. Gentlemen, Is a diagnosis in a child with CML, do you approach that any differently than adult? Because my son was diagnosed at 1 year of age with CML. He's now 20 months old. He's been on Gleevec 150 milligrams a day for the last 7 months, and now, according to the doctors here at Children's in Chicago, they've had seen a significant increase in the BCR-ABL in the PCR test. So right now they're deciding whether or not to put him on to the next generation. But should we be following or looking towards the way adults are treated? Just question.
That's an excellent question. Thank you. And Dr. Morrow, can you address that question in a general way in terms of the children with? Yes.
It is possible for very young individuals to develop what we would call adult-type CML. There are other chronic leukemias that can be similar to CML, but let's assume that. I know very young patients, boys and girls, with adult-type CML. And yes, all the same tools that we use in adult CML, we do use in children. The approach is different in a few ways. The dosing, as you might expect, would be different. The notion of the breadth of treatment options, particularly how do we place the use of oral medications, which we know can treat the disease, put it into remission, hopefully control it for extended periods of time, how we use those in context of what are more proven curative options, such as a bone marrow transplant or stem cell transplant, particularly in someone who's very young and who obviously is still vulnerable. We're all vulnerable at any age, but children have fairly high success rates with bone marrow and stem cell transplant. They can do quite well, and they have their whole lives ahead of them. The notion of long-term remission from medications like Gleevec and even the second-generation drugs is obviously a bit more of an unknown. And for that reason, stem cell bone marrow transplant is probably considered much more strongly or urgently, or at least the option is explored quite aggressively, and I think that's very reasonable. But I think it's useful to at least get treatment and get someone feeling better, get the disease under control, even a very young child, and to give specific advice about this case is a little bit hard. I would obviously encourage you to make sure that the doctors are kind of giving you this perspective on that. You know, ask them obviously about the adult versus the pediatric perspective. I would have to say that the development's been a little bit more calculated and a bit slower pace than in children than adults, again, because of the availability of stem cell transplant, because of some of the natural differences, and also because this is a population of special interest, you know, special concern. Kids are different in that they're obviously developing rapidly, their metabolism can change, there's a lot going on at all the stages of youth, and it's a tricky question, but all the same tools are available, the same testing, the same medication. So if you have a question about another drug and you're hearing about something that you think might be an option, or you think that other things should be considered that might be considered adults, I would definitely encourage you to bring them to the healthcare team.
Thank you for asking that wonderful question in terms of, in behalf of your child. And I also want Rick to just comment on just what about you, because certainly as a parent of a child with cancer, there is a lot of support services that we'd like to be sure that you are aware of. I know that your focus is always, of course, on your child, but we also have to think about you and any support we can give you. So, Rick, do you want to comment on just the range of support services that would be available?
Well, thank you, Carolyn. In cancer care, definitely our services extend, as I briefly said in my presentation. They do extend not just to patients, but to family members, and because the pressure and stress that is put on family members, caregivers, the primary caregivers. Now, within that context, a lot of times it's very important, and having developed our Mind, Body, Spirit program, to really be aware of the stress and the impact of taking care of somebody who is ill and dealing with a potentially chronic illness or a very time-consuming illness, taking care of yourself, whether that's carving out time through the help of friends to come and take care of the loved one, or whether it is some very simple mind-body-spirit techniques such as meditation, imagery, vibration as therapy, and prayer itself. Many people do belong to houses of worship, get a great strength, or just to the spirit of nature. To find places to replenish the caregiver is very important when the pressures of taking care of somebody, and especially the unique features when you have a very young one involved and the stressors there. So cancer care does help. It's very hard nationally for us to provide some counseling services to children through our national offices. They just don't respond as well to the telephone or online services, but parents can access those services. And our social workers are trained to help people find those psychosocial services, social workers, nurse practitioners, people in their community who can maybe help them with the ongoing struggles of dealing with a very young one with cancer.
So we're really a wonderful resource just for you to call us and really us to reach out to you as well to kind of really get some support for you. And sometimes because you are so involved with your child and with them all the time, that sometimes to you the telephone or the Internet could be very helpful in terms of you don't have to travel anywhere to communicate with us. We're right there. And there may also be staff right where your child is being treated that also could provide you support. But in this
and Carolyn,
instance,
could I just
the more
add
the better,
that too.
Always better. The more support is always better sometimes than less sometimes, yes.
And Carolyn, just to say, social workers, and as I mentioned, most oncology teams do work with a social worker. Social workers are often providing these services to the people being treated there. They're often open to the community, and they are connected to community resources. Because of the nature of cancer so often being a chronic condition, even when treatment ends, the worry and the psychological implications of dealing with cancers or follow-up care, the social worker where you're being treated is a very good point of entry and at least making contact. And oftentimes, unfortunately, because they are overworked and understaffed in many centers, you do have to request to speak to one. But if you do, they can often really guide you and help you with regional and local resources across the spectrum of emotional supports, financial assistance, home care assistance, and many other things that are very crucial to taking care of somebody who is dealing with a chronic illness.
Well, while we're waiting, I want to ask Dr. Morrow if, in concluding the program, if you could comment just on the, you know, just the concept of, you know, evidence-based medicine and, you know, and clinical wisdom and the art of medicine a bit in terms of the treatment of people living with CML.
We've seen a revolution happen in CML, and it's really set an example for the rest of cancer. We didn't think it was possible that we could unravel a disease and identify a specific target that would be both important to treat in the development of a new treatment, the first of its kind. It would be the same thing to go after the, when that first medicine perhaps wasn't a good fit. And yet still the same thing to go after even in the third or fourth round. It really has been a testimony to rational thought and rational development of therapeutics. The sentinel work by my mentor, Brian Druker, to put these things together, the detailed understanding of how CML happens, followed by how a targeted drug could undo that, and then the excellent collaboration between patients and physicians and industry to help develop not one, not two, not three, we already have three, but probably yet even more treatment options for patients. And as we move now into the 12th year, really, of when these drugs first saw the light of day, we have the wonderful news that patients with CML are living and with their disease, and the it's a new world, and the advances hopefully will continue with yet further treatment options, further trials, further careful inquiry, as I alluded to, into some of the important questions about length of treatment and monitoring, and I think it's a very good world right now. For those who unfortunately have this diagnosis, we have just wonderful tools at hand.
Excellent. Well, I really want to thank you, Dr. Morrow and Rick Dickens, for just excellent presentations, very informative and very compassionate as well, but with lots of information for everybody and with great hope, actually. So thank you. And I also want to thank you who've been listening to the call and all of you who've been able to queue up and ask questions, excellent questions that really enhanced our call today. And I do want to remind you this is a one-hour education program and that in planning a program like this, we know that you have so many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I don't want anyone to leave this call feeling that you are alone. I want you to now know that you're part of a community of support, and that includes Cancer Care, and that I'd like you to really take advantage of those services. Call us. Rick has done a wonderful job in telling you about our services. Call us at 1-800-813-HOPE. We're happy to help you in any way we can. But most importantly, you are not alone in coping with your cancer. You do have resources to utilize and also lots of helpful tips and information that you can take advantage of. So I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.